there.
Sunday, March 11th, 2012.
So, we begin the class with reciting this prayer here. We do the first four lines there and say it three times. I go for refuge and full enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of giving the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge and full enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of giving the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge and full enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of giving the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. So, Skypers have to remember to mute there, and then, we have to orient ourselves. Where we were last week was, you have a different book than I do, chapter 5, called the Bodhisattva Deeds. And we got up to verse 110. There was one reference I made in the previous class, and I'd like to continue with that. I talked about the four reliances, I said what the first reliance was, but I don't know if I counted the number of reliances, but there are three more. We talked about the first one, which is to rely on the teaching, but not on the teacher. That means not to rely on the person of the teacher. Teachers say that, it's hard to determine if a teacher is a good teacher or not unless you investigate what they teach, right? I mean, you could rely on people's hearsay and just what people say about a teacher, or reputation, or that means reputation, really. And then but you can be easily misled by that, because people, especially in a culture where Hollywood exists, you know, people tend to exaggerate the qualities of people, of well-known people. So then you have to see what they wrote, and then you investigate what it is that they, what is their idea that they're teaching. And so the Buddha encouraged his followers to not rely on him simply because he said he is the enlightened one, but because of what he teaches and how you determine what he teaches. And so then that means we have to also think about what the ideal student is. In Buddhism, the ideal student or follower of the Buddha is somebody who analyzes what the teacher says with an open mind, not with a partisan mind, not with a biased attitude, where you're saying, well, the Buddha said it, so it must be true. That's not true. And I'm a Buddhist, you know. And what the other people say isn't true, because I'm a Buddhist, and that's just what they say. You know, you can't, and as a Buddhist, you can't do like that. you have to have an open mind that examines exactly how the Buddha's teachings are, how other teachings are, and comes to a conclusion based on your own reasoning, how these teachings are and if they're true or not. And the Buddha emphasized that. He said, don't just take my word because I say I'm the enlightened one. You have to analyze it like a goldsmith analyzes gold, is the example that he gave. You have to cut it, melt it, burnish it, or polish it. And so then he's saying you have to examine it through from many different aspects. And in Buddhist logic, we have various ways to use reason and logic to analyze the teachings. But it comes down also to, besides to reason, to your own experience. You have to measure it in your own experience. So that was the first reliance. Rely on the teaching, not on the person. The second one is relying on the meaning and not on the words. I think a good example of this is, well, one example is, we have another book that we teach on Sundays called The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And it is one of the more famous books in India because the Sanskrit, it was originally written in Sanskrit, translated into the Tibetan. Nowadays, it's translated into both of those, rather, are translated into English. And it earned a reputation as beautiful Sanskrit poetry. But that's not the way you're supposed to be relying on the teaching. You're supposed to rely not on the, you know, how beautiful the words sound or how well it's written and so forth. It's the meaning. The meaning behind the words. I think we can sort of understand this when, I don't know how beautiful our, we say some prayers in the morning at 11, right? And I don't know how beautiful the words are, but if you're just saying the words and you don't know the meaning, it's not very effective. You know, you have to know the meaning of the words. The third one is rely on the definitive scriptures, not on the interpretable or provisional scriptures. This one comes because, again, these are what the Buddha is advising, okay, these four reliances. The Buddha, to become a Buddha means that you become among other things, it means that you become a perfect teacher. And a Buddha knows exactly what each person or each living being, sometimes he taught human beings, sometimes he taught deities, and then there's a large variety of other types of beings that the Buddha taught. And each one of his disciples, he knew exactly what he or she needed in order to progress to becoming enlightened, to becoming or improving themselves. And he could see what they would need in order to reach that goal of becoming enlightened eventually. But eventually all of us become enlightened. But a Buddha has that power to see exactly what a person needs and then to teach them individually. Said that a Buddha, well, actually the Buddha said himself, when he was born, he said, I am the great physician, the great doctor. What does that mean? Well, we know what a poor doctor is, you know. A poor doctor is somebody who would give the same medicine to everybody who showed up at the door. Take an aspirin, go to bed, you know, to everybody, okay? But that, so then a great physician is somebody who would know exactly what each person needed in order to overcome their individual ailment, whatever it might be, and to tailor the medicine for each one. And that's what the Buddha's ability is like. And when the Buddha teaches, he taught to each person individually what they needed. So then, the result is that you get a lot of different teachings, okay? And so then you have to try and make sense about all these different teachings. And sometimes the teachings sound very contradictory, depending on who he taught. Some people, it was appropriate to tell them there's one teaching in Buddhism called selflessness. Selflessness means that we have this misconception that our self is somehow independent, exists on its own, doesn't need anything else for its existence. You can, Brian.
Well, yeah. So what's the recommendation, that a person learns them all and we have to pick out which ones fit us or find a teacher?
Yeah, I'm getting there.
Okay.
Yeah, usually it's probably good to, unless you get really stuck, it's good to ask questions. I'll leave some period at the end of the class for questions, and then you can, you know, keep, make a note if you, I think there's, it was paper and pen. Yeah, right there.
Yep.
Hidden to the teacher here. Yeah, so you make a note of any questions you might have. I'll leave time at the end.
Sorry.
And so then you have all these. I'm trying to remember. I was making a point there with the
lots of scriptures.
Provisional teachings.
Provisional teachings. Did I call them provisional?
Definitive or interpretive.
Yeah. And okay.
Buddha taught depending on the person, so there's a lot of scriptures.
Yeah. Oh, that's where it was. Yeah, thanks.
Well,
it tripped it off. We were talking about selflessness.
I'm an excellent driver.
So then, sometimes, well, we have a tendency to think of ourselves, our gut feeling about ourselves is that we exist independent of anything else, that we don't need anything else for our existence. And so then that forms the very core of our, or the very basis for our negative emotions, for instance. Or our destructive emotions, which we have a lot of, like our anger, our jealousy, our pride, our hatred, our very strong sense of competitiveness, especially in this culture. These are all driven by this feeling of I am the one, me, I'm the person. Doesn't matter, and you know, you think of yourself as just being independent in that way. And then this teaching on selflessness is saying, well, that kind of a independent self could never exist. It's a totally false understanding of who you are, because obviously we exist in a very dependent way. We're dependent on breathing, we're dependent on eating, we're dependent on drinking. We're obviously dependent on other things for our existence. Our existence wouldn't be except for all these other things that we're dependent upon, let alone our mother and father for having conceived us. So it's obvious that we don't exist independently. But when we get really angry, then we think, I am correct. I. We have this really strong feeling of I. And if we hadn't thought about how we feel about the I at that time, the I sort of pops up there separate from the body and the mind. It seems to have its own existence. And that's what we're talking about. That's a misconception. But we accept that as being true. And the Buddha said, well, that's our ignorance. But then some people couldn't hear that teaching. And so then he would say, there is such an independent self. So then you get very contradictory teachings when you have a lot of different teachings. So you had to know how to pick your way through all. It's said that the Buddha taught 84,000 different kinds of teachings. So you had to know to pick your way through. And so that's where this idea of the provisional teachings and the definitive teachings come. But then the Buddha said, well, this is definitive, and then this is provisional. He would say like that. But that also you had to investigate because some of the Buddha identified as being provisional, and they're actually definitive. No, some of them as definitive, and they're actually provisional. And he taught many ways to different students. So then later on, then there came this whole system of how to distinguish between what is the definitive teaching and what is the interpretable teaching or provisional teaching. And so we were talking about this in the last class about how the Buddha described the universe in a certain way. And nowadays we couldn't possibly think of the universe as existing in that way. Well, that we don't have to think of the universe as thinking in that way, as existing in that way, because we could think of it as being provisional. That the Buddha was teaching, giving a description of the universe that worked for the people of that time. Mm-hmm. Okay. But since that time, we've had, exploration of outer space and so forth, and it becomes clear that, for instance, that the world is can no longer be thought of as being flat. one of the monks we lived with was very insistent the world was flat. And there's a whole flat earth society, right, in this country, right, that still insists that the world is flat. Even though we have, what do they call it, space shuttles, right, going around the globe, right? It's not quite round. It's supposed to be like a little oblong or something like that. So then he was kind of insistent when he first got here that it must be that way, flat. But then when he realized that the space shuttle was going around the world and determining with their own sight, right, that it was round, right, or relatively round, Then he said, well, I guess that's not correct. You know? He was sort of convinced by that idea. And why is that? Because we discussed it last week. We were saying that if it's subject to, you know, if you can have a direct perception that scripture that says the world is flat is wrong, right, about that, if, based upon our own sensory perception, then that scripture, that scriptural citation, that part of that scripture, is you don't have to accept it. You know, it's because it's contradicted by our own perceptions. So then, so basically, we have to rely on reason, and there are some scholars, in particular, who use reason with great, intelligence. The ones that in India, known as Nagarjuna and Asanga, are particularly adept at using Buddhist logic to investigate, you know, what is an interpretable teaching and what is, or a provisional teaching and what is a definitive teaching. So then you have to use your own intelligence to apply those lines of reason and then come up with your own assessment that are these two beings, you know, Asanga and Nagarjuna, are they teaching a method that actually, you know, establishes what are the definitive scriptures and what are the provisional scriptures. So in Buddhism, we have to do a lot of study, there's no doubt about it, and in order to come to a decision on our own, under our own power, as they say, not just based on what others say. You can't do it just based on what others say. You have to come to your own knowledge, you have to come to your own conclusion, you could say. So then, and it's like Geshe Ishitabe says, there's a lot of different groups of scholars and followers of the Buddha, actually, that came to their own conclusion about what the Buddha said, you know. And so we have this study of what we call the tenet systems, or different schools of thought. And then we have to, in Buddhist philosophy, you have to be able to investigate these different schools of thought that absolutely felt that they had the correct conclusion as to what the Buddha thought, you know, what the Buddha was saying. So it's a big process of using our own intelligence. And the Buddha, with an open mind and in a nonpartisan way, even though in Tibet they use this whole system of the four different tenet systems. But they say, well, the highest one is this. This is the best tenet system. So you're already kind of prejudiced right from the beginning, right? Oh, that must be the best, you think. And so then, but you have to keep an open mind and not to go from one side to the other and say, well, I like this one. This one's working. That makes a lot more sense than that one, you know. But they really are like rungs on a ladder. When you understand one and say, oh, this is really good, and then you get to the other one and you go, maybe, because you can read their refutations of the lower tenet system and then go, oh yeah, maybe it doesn't make sense. Well, this one sounds better, you know, the next one. So you can go through the whole process of analysis yourself. So that's Buddhist philosophy. An important part of being a Buddhist is to study philosophy. Then the last of the four reliances is rely on sublime wisdom, not on ordinary consciousness. So then, This is what one develops through using your intelligence, your wisdom, really, to understand what the Buddha taught. The reason the Buddha wanted you to not be partisan and just say it, take what he said because he said was the enlightened one, is because he wanted you to develop wisdom. He wanted you to develop your own understanding. So then, when you develop wisdom, the Buddha said, better to rely on wisdom rather than to rely on your ordinary ways of perceiving and thinking about things. So that's the four alliances. And I mean, it's good to keep those in mind, because those are that's the way you can put Buddha's teachings into practice. You have to, and in Buddhism, we're not just learning in order to acquire information. We're learning in order to put it into practice, put what the Buddha said into practice. I was reading that nowadays colleges, a lot of the, there's this whole movement of getting away from lectures, like me, you know, lectures. I'm trying not to just be a lecturer, but and I'm not just giving you information. Lecturers tend to be just giving students information, and then there's this whole movement to, well, how do you acquire, you know, how do you really remember, what is it, how do you really, you know, bring knowledge into you so that it remains with you, right? You can remember what the teacher taught and so forth for a very short time, actually. I forget, 3 months? It's like really short. But for those who are like majoring in that particular area, then they tend to retain it for a longer time. But what they've learned is that through surveying people after college is that the knowledge that they actually retain is knowledge that they put it into practice, you know, in their field of their career, you know, if they repeatedly learning actually happens through repetition. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen just through hearing it one time and then retaining that. It's hard to retain that for a long time. It takes repetition. And so that's what Buddha's practice is about. You know, I can explain what the Buddha said. This is what the Buddha said, and then you have to then put it into practice. That's so. It's not like we're not like a college here. And the emphasis is on putting it into practice. If you simply learn it as information, then it doesn't change who you are. You cannot transform your mind based on information, taking in information. You can through putting it into practice. So everybody's interested in meditation. That's a way of putting it into practice. But there's other ways as well. There's three ways of learning in Buddhism. You have to study. You have to reflect, and then you have to meditate. So these are just study. It means that you know the topic really well, debating it back and forth and getting to know it really well. And then reflection means that you're taking that knowledge and making it and ingesting it, making it part of you by reflecting on it constantly. Thinking about what does it mean? How does that impact on my other areas of knowledge? Just constantly bringing it to mind, reflecting on it, and thinking, "Oh, this is really directing me on how to put the teachings into practice. I have to then put the teachings into practice according to what is being said here." The Buddha didn't waste his time. He was always telling you how to practice in order to transform your mind. And so then you have to reflect on that and see how it impacts you and how it's going to, how that works into as a method of changing your mind. Then when you get that deeper level of understanding, then you meditate on that to really get it into your very being, your very way of thinking and acting. Then you can transform your mind completely so that you see things and do things in a totally different way, out of what we call wisdom and compassion. You can transform your mind into having great compassion without any discrimination between anybody, an unbiased attitude of compassion for all. And then you can have this profound wisdom that knows the way things are, just how things actually exist. So maybe we'll get to our verses now. I have all sorts of books here. You can see your paper and pen. I can't see it. And you can't see all the books I have here. Had to make some notes. So, verse 110 on page 139. But it's always better to orient ourselves by going to the topical outline in the back, page 313. Then, so you see on page 313, if you look at that Roman numeral number 2, we're explaining how to practice the Bodhisattva deeds, the cause of Buddhahood. Bodhisattva is somebody who has a... in Tibetan means that they have this attitude of the altruistic spirit of enlightenment, of bodhisattva. So you can understand a bodhisattva from their attitude. And the altruistic spirit of enlightenment, as we're not just interested in the words, we're interested in the meaning. And then the meaning of that is that it's the desire to attain perfect enlightenment for the sake of others. We want to become enlightened in order to be a benefit to others. And therefore, we want to become perfect teachers as well. We want to be able to determine exactly what others need in order to progress and to be free of their suffering, the main cause the main aim, of the bodhisattva is somebody who wants to free all beings from their suffering, wants to not just interested in his or her own suffering, but wants to free all beings from suffering. And so they have that attitude. And they have the goal of becoming enlightened, becoming a Buddha, because they understand that's the best way to free all living beings from their suffering. If I become a Buddha, if I reach perfection, then I will know exactly what another person needs in order to be helped. And so it's not like your normal teacher who just sort of is, guessing what others need in order to be helped. A Buddha knows exactly what a person needs, just like we know that that's a chair there. It's just obvious to them. It stands right out. So the Bodhisattva is seeking to become a Buddha. And then engages in various activities, deeds, in order to do that. So then we're on verse 110, which is in that section C there, which is the actual mode of training in the deeds, the actual way to train in the bodhisattva deeds. And 110 is the specific attitude that a bodhisattva has when they're training in the deeds of the bodhisattva. And 110 says the stages of guiding trainees. we translators of Tibetan come up with these interesting words. Trainees are merely students of the teacher, and then you can think of it just as students. But we use the loma, means like trainee, because the teacher is teaching them how to practice, right? How to train themselves. It's like the mind is very similar to the body. In order to jump 6 feet, you have to train yourself in order to get over that bar. You have to train your body, and eventually the body can get over 6 feet. And so then it's the same with a student. They have to train their minds in order to, for instance, stop getting angry or saying something offensive to somebody else, you know, when you get angry. And then, if you train yourself, then you can actually do that when you feel yourself getting angry. You can stop yourself and not say those nasty things. I say that because I do that all the time, but I don't stop myself, unfortunately. So I try to stop myself. That's what Buddhist training is all about. So then at verse 110, okay, these are the actual stages of how to train the student, the bodhisattva, as we're thinking of the bodhisattva as being a spiritual guide here and helping others to. Spiritual is a much used word that has too many different meanings to actually be effective to use anymore, so we actually try to avoid using the word spiritual, but it shows up in so many books. The meaning of it is really spiritual means, in the Buddhist context, means to change the mind, to transform the mind. Okay, doing some kind of practice that helps us to control the mind. Why is that? To discipline the mind. Why do we need to discipline the mind? Maybe, does anybody know? I can ask you. Put it to this.
So it'll keep a check on our mouth.
Yeah, exactly. Everything follows from the mind. Okay, all our activities follow from, whether we say something or do something physically, it follows from the mind. Even we can plan something in our mind. That idea of like thinking, oh boy, it'd be nice to have that person's car, you know, or something like that. That looks like a great car. You know, that kind of, we call that covetousness, you know, wanting it yourself. That also is an activity that's motivated by our greed, right? So we have to think that we have to discipline our mind, right? We have to discipline our body. We have to discipline our speech, ethical discipline is what it's called. That's what ethics is about. So then the mind is where everything comes from. You know, you can feel that if you have some greed, right? Then you start planning about getting that car and maybe stealing it, you know. But if you went back, right, to what the cause of that was, it's happening in the mind, okay? So Buddhism is about changing your mind, okay? On page 139, that for which someone has liking should first be assessed. Those who are disinclined will not be vessels for the excellent teaching. So a spiritual guide, somebody who's guiding somebody on how to transform their mind, right? Teaching students should discuss whatever practices, such as giving, that appeals to a particular trainee. So it's whatever practice that appeals to a particular trainee. And giving or being generous, right? So that's, we're talking about a student who's attracted to this idea of being generous. Having first taught this properly, an assessment should be made. So it's saying what the bodhisattva does, taking what a person likes, right? One should only discuss the profound later, after initial and subsequent instruction has been given. So this is the idea that the profound teaching, the teachings on the nature we were talking about earlier, selflessness, the profound teachings on how things actually are, but that this independent self, for instance, doesn't exist at all. We also tend to think of objects as existing independently. So that's why I say the self, for instance. We talk about a selflessness of objects and a selflessness of persons. So only to discuss those later. You only discuss the teachings on selflessness of phenomena, selflessness of persons later. After initial and subsequent instruction has been given. Those whose minds are disinclined because of being deterred by discussion of the profound at the outset will not be receptive vessels for the ultimate teaching. So there's this idea of an ultimate teaching. That's why I was talking about the definitive, right? The definitive teaching, the ultimate teaching, you know, on selflessness, right? These, you have to be careful not to teach those right from the beginning, because some people dislike them, like I was talking about, that some people feel that the self has to exist. So then the Buddha said, oh yeah, the self, this independent self exists, okay, this independent self that you feel, that we all feel, you know, exists. It exists, okay. Whereas in other contexts, he said, it doesn't exist, that there's no such thing as an independent self. So, and then he would teach what is the correct thing for them in terms of what they were interested in, right? The miserly dislike talk of generosity. So you don't talk about being generous to somebody who wants to hold on to things. It's a great chapter on it, and a great treatise about miserliness. The thing that you have to overcome in terms of being generous is just wanting to hold on. You know, it's really, I think, in our language, we would say tight-fisted. You don't want to. That person's really tight, you know, because they want to hold on to it. So then, that's the obstacle to being generous. You have to learn how to let go of it, and so then, but for somebody who's really, you know, really has a problem with that, you can't tell them to be generous right from the beginning. So that's what, and then the translator put in some other commentary that says, the angry do not like to hear about patience, nor those with loose morality about ethical conduct. People who don't control themselves don't like to be, not to hear about and being told to. They think, they're just telling me what to do, or something like that. So you have to think of some, you have to find out what they do like to hear. Therefore, those who desire resources should be told to give. This is the teaching that if you want to have things, you know, a place to stay and things to eat, you know, clothing and so forth, if you want those in the future, in the future life is what this means, then you have to give in this life. So it's for somebody who really wants those resources, you know, in their future lifetime, we're talking about, then you have to teach them to be generous in generous in this lifetime, then you will have plenty in your next lifetime. Even in this lifetime, people have a feeling, you know, that when they're becoming more and more generous, that everything comes because of their generosity. You know, it comes back to them anyway, even though they give it all away. Like, for instance, before Bakshi's, our founder's death, he gave away half of the resources of this learning center to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And then right before he died, one of his disciples gave back double that to him. So it was, and that was just in her will. So it wasn't something intentionally that she had done. But that's Alice. You see her up in the temple there, her picture on the wall. Yeah, she was the patron who left the money in her will so that we could build that building. So it's like that, and that's kind of instant results. That it's not very. They're really talking about, you know, in your future life when you are generous in this life. Like Bakshi will have resources in his next life after giving away half the resources here. Not necessarily so that it's all going to come back, but it's probably. It's more like, well, you never know. It could have been because of that, or it could have been because of, you know, something he had done in a former life is what in Buddhism they say.
Is that what His Holiness is referring to when he says to be wisely selfish?
Yeah, exactly. You got it. That's wise selfless. If you want resources in your next life, give now. So then, those who want high status, that means a rebirth as a human or a deity, that's high status, will like to hear about ethics, okay? Through ethical conduct, through conducting yourself mentally, physically, and verbally, properly, and through avoiding the 10 non-virtuous deeds and cultivating the 10 virtuous deeds, then you will get, as a result of that, a human rebirth or a birth as a deity in your next lifetime. So that's what that's talking about in terms of ethical conduct. In Buddhism, you have ethical conduct of body, speech, and mind. 10, we call them the 10 non-virtuous deeds, usually non-virtuous actions or constructive actions, where you're avoiding killing, stealing, and adultery. That's the physical ones, mm-hmm. And then the verbal ones are avoiding lying, divisive speech, offensive speech, like I was saying before, about saying things that hurt people's feelings, and senseless speech, where you're just talking out of, you know, your own. An example of senseless speech is you're just sort of talking from the viewpoint of your own greedy desires, something like that. And then the three of the mind, you avoid covetousness, malice, and wrong view. These 10 non-virtuous deeds, then, are you avoiding them is a way to cultivate being constructive, and then. You can, the 10 virtuous deeds would be the opposite of those. like to do. Instead of killing to save life, instead of stealing, giving, you know, being generous, like that, just the opposite. So then, and those who desire a good appearance will enjoy hearing about patience. That's the result of being patient, is that you're handsome or beautiful in your next lifetime. You have an appealing physical form in your next lifetime. It's kind of interesting. I always thought that was interesting because you can, when somebody gets really angry and you know, and says hateful things and so forth, everybody turns away, you know, because it's very difficult to look, right? Not attractive at all. So then that's it's sort of like, oh yeah, it makes sense that you know, if you're patient and tolerant of others, not hateful and so forth, then and forgiving and so forth, then you have a very pleasant, that's very pleasant to, when you know somebody is that way, they appear pleasant to you, whereas you know, if they're hateful and angry, then you'd rather be in the next room. So then it is like the following analogy. The Bodhisattva Keshava gradually guided a merchant's daughter according to her disposition. Then the translator explains that story using a different source. A merchant's daughter, crazed by attachment, carried her husband's corpse on her shoulders. To relieve her suffering, the Bodhisattva Keshava, who was a doctor, carried a woman's corpse on his shoulders for 6 months. Just to help that person feel relieved, right? Doing something that appealed to that person, right? Instead of using that example of doing something that they like, right? Do you ever see that Lonesome Dove movie, for instance, where it's all about carrying this corpse all around? I suppose somebody could carry a corpse for that long, right? So then, get a little smelly, I'll tell you.
Thank you.
6 months in India, especially.
Misery loves company.
Yeah, that's a good example. Yeah. So that's the stages of the teaching, right? The topical outline tells us exactly what, you know, the author Aryadeva in this verse 110 was getting to. The person who created that topical outline is the one who created this commentary, you know, that's below the verse. And there's another commentator, when the story, like of the Bodhisattva Keshava, that story is usually comes from a different source. It comes from another commentator in India, Chandrakirti. Then when she puts them in brackets, that comes from another commentator. She's a translator. She's not trying to explain the verses herself. She's translating other... there's a whole commentarial tradition that started when Aryadeva spoke these verses and then explained what they meant to his students. And so then there's a whole commentarial tradition of explanation of what Aryadeva was saying. Then in the next verse, a bodhisattva is particularly compassionate to one who, despite having been stopped from doing wrong 100 times, again and again engages in improper actions. So that's the commentary, talking about somebody who's very recalcitrant. Just as a mother is especially anxious about a sick child, bodhisattvas are especially compassionate toward the unwise. So the idea here is that in Buddhism, actually, this verse reminds me of His Holiness the Dalai Lama often talks about how we have to be more compassionate for the perpetrator of the crime as opposed to the victim of the crime. Compassion is like that. The person who has the more suffering, you have to have more compassion for them, and a teacher also for those who are looking to them for guidance, you know, more, what do you say, needing it more than others, right? Then their compassion for them is greater because they have to respond more to that person with a greater sense of trying to help them get out of their suffering, in a greater sense of empathy for their suffering. So just as a mother is especially anxious about a sick child, bodhisattvas are especially compassionate towards the unwise. Here, when you look at the topical outline on page 313, it says, being particularly compassionate towards those with very strong disturbing emotions. Disturbing emotions is like anger, hatred, pride, distraction. These are all sorts of different disturbing emotions. The mind is sort of, if you sit quietly and you're not having anything rise your emotions, right? Your strong destructive emotions we're talking about, then the mind is kind of naturally quiet, right? It just sort of stays quietly, like we can get in situations where we just sort of feel very quiet. And then something happens and we get all riled up, right, is what we'd say. So that's why the translators use the word disturbing emotions, the things that disturb the mind, right? Anger and pride and all of those disturb the mind. Whereas if you discipline the mind and control those, the mind quiets down and relaxes, okay? It relaxes and becomes very calm, peaceful. So in Buddhism, then, when we're talking about happiness, we're talking about that peaceful state of mind, not influenced by the disturbing emotions, which we call also the afflictions. So here we're talking about being particularly compassionate towards those with very strong disturbing emotions. So if we read the commentary, a mother, for instance, feels especially anxious about a sick child. Similarly, bodhisattvas are especially compassionate toward the unwise. I pick up what the Tibetan for unwise here. I think it just means somebody who, let's see. Huh. I'm a member. What's that?
Would that mean to be particularly compassionate to people that don't have benefit of the teachings?
No, to people who, in the Tibetan it's unusual. These are early Tibetan words, you know, so then they change meaning over the centuries. And so, but this one, just means that they're, well, she came up with this word, unwise. They're just not, they don't know how to think in order to control their, you know, their negative emotions. That's what basically what's being said. With people are just, you know, they don't know what it is. Like we had that verse earlier. The reason that you're the student is because you don't know what to do in order to control your mind. You know, you're the student of the Buddha in order to learn it. Otherwise, and the teacher then is the one who tells you how to do it. So then, you know, in a sense, we're all unwise, right? We're acquiring the wisdom to know how to discipline our minds, how to control, you know, negative emotions, if you like, or afflictive emotions, another way of saying, or destructive emotions, so that we can become more constructive members of our human society, basically. Be of help to others. It is like the following analogy. Chandala, I think you have to say, Chandala woman greatly feared that the king would put her sixth son to death because of his wrong deeds. That's the story. She had six sons, and she was really fearful of one of their sons. So then Chandrakirti's explanation, you know, description of this story is that Chandala woman means a woman in a certain part of India. She had five of whose sons were exalted ones. Exalted ones means that they were
good kids.
Yeah, they were really good kids. Yeah, they were noble beings. Is the way that's the way we translate it. That they were highly evolved spiritually. Highly evolved spiritually means that they were able to control their minds completely. These were somebody who really had gotten, you know, very far along on the path to becoming enlightened. They're much closer. And so she had five sons who were like that. And so she was not anxious when the king threatened to put them to death if they did wrong, for she had no fear of them doing so. They would never do anything wrong because they couldn't possibly conceive of it, because their minds had become so purified, right? However, she was worried when he threatened the sixth son, because he was an ordinary person and she feared he might do no wrong. Because he was an ordinary person and she feared he might do wrong. Don't get distracted, you two. You have to report to your class. Your teacher will say, he's going to act, you know, ask you what you learned. So then we have this difference, right, between the sixth son and the other five sons. The other five sons were exalted ones. We said, so what? I think it's helpful to understand what an exalted one is. Why would they not do any wrong? Okay, how is it that you could possibly reach a state where you never do anything wrong? Okay. It's possible. What's that? No, they haven't reached perfection, but they're close to it. That's a good guess. Exalted ones are really very close to becoming Buddhas, but they're still.
Is that wrongdoing?
What's that?
So what's missing?
What's missing is that they've gotten rid of the acquired. You know, we have this misconception of the self as being inherently being independently existent, existing on its own. And that causes all our negative emotional life, you know, where we get angry and do something and hurt somebody, or we, really want something and we steal it, you know. All of that comes through our, this negative emotional life. And it comes about because we have this strong feeling of an independent self, okay? And we can say all of our troubles in the world come because of that feeling of an independent self, okay? We can see countries get into warfare because of the leaders getting very proud and, or defensive or whatever. And nowadays in Syria, killing their own people. How could it be worse than that? So then, it's this idea of ignorance. But you can see it in your own self when you get really angry, like I was saying before. If you investigate with your own mind, how do I think of myself when I'm feeling justified in saying something back to somebody when they say something nasty to me? You feel justified. You feel, I can say that because they said it to me. You know, it's a strong feeling of I that comes up, and that strong feeling of I that we're thinking at that time couldn't possibly exist in the way that it appears to exist. Okay, it exists in a certain way. There is an I that exists dependently, certainly. But there's no I that exists independent of your mind and body. How could that possibly exist? You know? So then, these exalted ones don't have this feeling of I. But it's the one that's dependent upon, it's the acquired one, we call it, that you have mistaken systems of understanding the self that you learn from a very young age up to when you can stop that, you know. And so it's just wrong ways of thinking about the self that create this misperception that the self exists on its own. So then, or independent. It's sort of self-contained and doesn't need anything else for its existence. So then, these noble ones have eliminated that. These noble beings, or exalted ones, we're calling them here, have eliminated that feeling of I, you know. But they haven't eliminated the innate one, this one when we're born. Just at the very moment we're born, we're thinking I right away. You know, we're thinking I'm hungry. You know, and you want to have some of your mother's milk, right? And so it's just sort of like, but even before that, you think I, and then you go, oh, my body. You know, it's just sort of, oh. And I'm hungry. You know, it's just that there's just this innate sense of I that comes, and you think I am more important. The most important thing for me is to get some food. You know, at that time, you know, And so then you think of yourself as being more important than what you need, you're not thinking of your mother and all what she just went through. You're not thinking like that, although they'd say that some children can do that. But then, that kind of an I, the innate sense of I, and then these innate negative emotions like innate anger and innate, pride and all these are all the noble ones have to work on those, okay? They've overcome these other ones, but they haven't overcome those. No, they don't do wrong, because they actually, when they are able to overcome that acquired sense, or we call it acquired ignorance. Ignorance is the mind that conceives of that kind of self, right? Misconceives, as we say. Ignorance is not in Buddhism is not knowing the self. It's simply misconceiving the self.
Actively misknowing.
It means that because the I seem appears to you, to me, to all of us, to exist independently, then we accept the way it appears. You know, we just say, "Oh, that must be true," and then we just sort of we're deluded. Okay. And another way of thinking of that is, the people call it, instead of disturbing emotions, the delusions is another way. Just because we're deluded in thinking that, just because it appears that way, that it actually exists that way. You have to undermine that delusion with using reason, saying that nothing could possibly exist on its own. For instance, that chair, right? It looks very much like it exists on its own there. It doesn't have, it has some kind of independent, self-contained existence, even though, and that's just the way it appears. It's just the way it appears. And so then we could accept the way it appears, that it does have this independent existence. But if you thought about it, if you just even cast your mind towards, well, how did it get there? You know, it had to have been created by various causes and conditions in order to be there at all. Okay. And then that it stays there, it has certain causes and conditions that allow it to stay there. So then we can sort of reason out that it doesn't have this independent existence. But if we just accept the way things appear, then that's our ignorance, okay? And that's what we tend to do. But somebody who's reached this stage of an exalted one doesn't do that at all. And so then what happens is that they then don't create, any more, we say karma, okay. Karma means that they don't get involved in actions that are going to have either... that are going to result in them being reborn again. Okay, they only engage in what we call pure actions, motivated with their motivation is like totally changed. They don't get involved in creating impure actions. But then, still that sense of having gotten of self, right? They can maintain a sense of that kind of the non-existence of that self for a certain period of time, and then they sort of, from meditating, and then they have to meditate more in order to increase it so that it stays with them all the time. So they can fall back into having a false sense of self, right? And So that's what they're engaged in, to reach perfection. They have to, you know, it's called the path of meditation. They get accustomed to that more and more. And then they're able to maintain a correct view of self. And so she's not worried about them because they know how to, avoid actions that are going to cause them to be it's easy to follow laws, right, that the king has made. It's a lot harder to control their emotions all the time, right? For them it would be a lot easier just to follow the laws of the land. And so then they're working on these other innate destructive emotions. So, we're actually getting near the end of our class, and so if there are any other questions like Brian had about the exalted ones. And,
what is the suggested?
Do you want the microphone?
Oh, yeah, right.
So that the Skypers can hear your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, got it.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. I forget completely. The people on. Yeah, we can.
Yeah, I don't know.
Check.
There you go, it works. Okay, yeah.
All right, so my original question was if there's 84,000 different ways the Buddha taught, what's my suggested path? Should I go find a teacher that's going to know what I need to continue, or am I supposed to figure that out on my own?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, you're always having to figure it out on your own, but because you have to put what the teacher says to your own analysis. You have to use your own intelligence to analyze what the teacher is saying. So it's never off your own shoulders, right? But there are people who, know the teachings well, right, and more than yourself. So you have to determine mainly if the teacher knows more than you do, so that they know something that you need to acquire, You need to acquire that knowledge, right? And then it's helpful if the person has some concern for others, right? You have to distinguish if that person has some compassion, that would be helpful too. But I mean, even before that, it's helpful. You can study on your own, right? In this culture, we tend to take books and study on our own. But the tradition is that the reason I'm reading and then explaining is because the books never actually explain everything that needs to be known, right? So then the way I learned was learning with a teacher who could explain the meaning of what was written, right, in the book, in the scriptures or books, whatever you want to say, treatises. And then that's the way you study. You have to. But the advantage of having a teacher then is that then you can ask questions.
It speeds it up, too.
Yeah. What's that?
It speeds it up,
yeah, right. You can just sort of wander around in these books, But then, and everybody's trying to write the book that really tells you what Buddhism's all about. But you can't, But then there are certain books that have been written very well.
That's what I need.
Yeah.
I don't even know what books to do.
Yeah, right. And then there are better books. And that's, there's certain books that I can recommend, to read. But there's a teaching called the Stages of the Path to Enlightenment. And that has teachings for various levels, of a student's interest, you could say, or a student's inclination. So the teachings that we're talking about now are for somebody who wants to be completely free of suffering, okay? Who doesn't want that? But there are others, right? Who doesn't want that? Well, there are others who would just as soon, have
they, a... They want, they don't just don't know, they don't know what they don't know yet.
The others are interested in becoming getting a good rebirth in their next lifetime. That's their main concern. So there are certain teachings for that, okay? And then those form a basis for this person who then wants to, be completely free of suffering, understanding that even if you get a better rebirth, you'll have to
suffer.
You'll suffer again, so it'd be better just to work on getting out of suffering now. And then there are the others that automatically want to help others to get out of suffering. That's the only thinking, how can I be of help to others to get out of their suffering? I don't care about my own suffering. I care about their suffering. And so then there are teachings for that. So then it's sort of like there's different levels of entering into the teachings. And you don't have to think of yourself as any one of those categories, really. I mean, what our teacher who comes in the summer recommends, who's a very skilled scholar from Tibet originally, in India nowadays, he recommends that you focus on the practices for the person who's trying to get a better rebirth, because we all need a better rebirth, regardless of whether we want to get out of suffering or we want to be enlightened. But then when we... Then we can practice these teachings, the higher teachings, the more advanced teachings of, those for a better rebirth, like we talked about previously, were based on ethical conduct, following certain, a code of behavior for when we speak, when we use our bodies, right, physical actions, verbal actions, and mental actions. Then you can then focus on the teachings that interest you, and particularly, like the teachings on wisdom and so forth, that are wisdom, this one wisdom teachings that are the teachings on selflessness, right, is what we call selflessness. Then the purpose of that is to get out of suffering completely, okay? That is eliminating the cause of suffering. So then you work as hard as you can at that while you're maintaining these others. And then the teachings for a person of, more advanced is they're always thinking about, how others are more important than yourself, right? And so you try your hardest to work on changing your orientation according to those teachings so that you're thinking more of others and less about yourself, It's just... So that then you it's a lot to practice, but you can and it's a lot to learn. But if you sort of keep that kind of, I like that because that approach, because it keeps the whole of the path of mental transformation. We have to mature ourselves, okay, over time. And hopefully we become, through practice, then that you can mature. Maturing yourself just means that, you become, you advance on that kind of a step-by-step process, right, of mental transformation towards becoming a perfect person, which is a Buddha. A Buddha is the goal, and that we keep in mind, and then we use these practices to go towards that.
John,
Rick, yeah, sure.
Is this term exalted one connected with the idea of arhant or arhat?
Connected, but this is This is really Arya. You know, we use the word Arya for, and it gets associated with the Aryans, you know, and under Hitler, right? So then, it's better to use this word exalted one instead of using the Sanskrit Arya, as Aryan means Sanskrit, and. But it's talking about a certain level of the arhat. Actually, the one you're talking about is the goal of this exalted one. That they reach their final goal. Then they're known as an arhat or foe destroyer. We use when we said the prayers up there. I think we use foe destroyer.
Yeah,
that's right. You've seen it
several times.
I usually use the word arhat because it's a Sanskrit term that's describing, you know, somebody who's completely gotten out of suffering. Okay, they've reached a state where they're completely free of suffering, and reached the there's two different vehicles, we call them, but kind of courses of Buddhist practice. One is called Hinayana, one is called Mahayana. Hinayana practice is for your own liberation. So then the arhat is completely free of suffering themselves, okay, for their own sake. But then there's the Mahayana arhat, which is really a Buddha, okay. So then a Buddha, a Mahayana arhat, is one who's reached the state of perfection and has this ability to be a benefit to all beings, you know, sort of like a universal savior. So so arhat is a little different, yeah. Exalted one, Pakpa. In the Tibetan, she's translating Pakpa, which means they're up and above, you know, over. Pakpa means to sort of rise up. I mean, they're exalted. They're, above others, right? Pakpa. And then another word for them that they see things totally different, right? They see things totally different from us. They're the Partongas rather than the Tsurtongas. We're sort of stuck in our ignorant view of things where we assent to the way things appear. You know, we misconceive things all the time. And they don't do that. They're like, they don't do that at all. They can see that it's happening, and they're totally differentiate. You know, they differentiate that is just the way things appear. Okay, they never get sucked into it.
Nice.
You know, especially when they're in meditation, and then for a while when they're out of meditation, and then as they get better of it, you know, it just lasts longer and longer until they become Buddhas.
Thank you.
Mm. Yeah, sure. Liz?
No.
Uh-oh. Liz has a question.
Just your friends on Skype want to hear.
These are stupid questions.
Not stupid questions.
Okay, I don't want it. A Bodhisattva is a Buddha to be. Are we all, or whoever practicing are they all Bodhisattvas? Or I'm not sure how to say it.
Oh, that's good. Bodhisattva, right. That's a good question. And some Buddhist cultures, actually, if you take a vow, the vow of the Bodhisattva, then you're called a Bodhisattva. Okay? You can, in some Buddhist cultures, it's that way. In the Tibetan Buddhism is different. That they feel a Bodhisattva is somebody who has attained this attitude of only wanting to become enlightened for others' sake. Okay, they constantly are like that. Okay, whether they're sleeping or eating or driving a car or whatever, they're always thinking that way. Okay, I have to become enlightened for the sake of others, and so I can be a benefit to others. They never stop thinking that. So it's a radical change in the way you're thinking, in the way you're oriented, in radical change in your attitude. So then that's a bodhisattva. Somebody who has that kind of attitude spontaneously all the time is called a bodhisattva. We're all here as Tibetan Buddhists. We're aspiring to be bodhisattvas. You know, that's where you can think of it that way. We all want to become bodhisattvas, to have that attitude all the time spontaneously. And so bodhisattvas, but then there are other cultures where they think that we're bodhisattvas because we took the vow to liberate all beings from their suffering, and therefore I'm a bodhisattva. But we say that gives you a false sense of pride, right? That you're not actually that. If you're not actually, you can't call yourself a bodhisattva. So then, and then what it does is sort of would be a problem, because then you'd think, well, I don't have to do these lower practices, you know, the, like ethical conduct and so forth, because I'm a bodhisattva, right? And then I don't have to develop understanding of selflessness and so forth, you know. So it can be very, you know, misleading and counterproductive in some people. I'm sure it helps some other people, you know, to think of themselves as bodhisattvas, and they might have a great sense of working and helping others, right? And so that's not wrong, but on the whole, it's hard because there's no Buddhas to say exactly what you need, right? So then teachings over time, over the centuries, have become sort of this general thing that what you need is everything, okay? You have to practice everything. So it's very, you know, it's kind of hard on the later followers of the Buddha, right? They have to do all the practices. But like I was saying, you can put them in perspective, you know, like, you know, practice the beginning practices of ethical conduct and then use the other ones for liberation and for enlightenment to the best of your ability.
And then also, what is a sentient being and altruistic, whatever that phrase was?
The altruistic spirit of enlightenment?
Yeah.
She's asking, what is a sentient being and what is the altruistic spirit of enlightenment? The ascension being is just another way of, it's a way of translating the Tibetan term, you know. So it's semchen, so everybody translates it as sentient being. I personally translate it as living being, you know, or just a being, some kind of living being. It doesn't include plants and so forth. And in our understanding of what's living, right? But it's something that has a mind, right? It's something that's a sentient being. Sentient means to have a mind. So then it helps to translate that in specific contexts where, you know, the emphasis is on the fact that they have a mind. And so but then people always are going, well, what's a sentient being, you know? And it sort of sounds like some, you know, something from sci-fi. Outer space or something, you know?
Like a sci-fi.
What's that?
Like a sci-fi character.
Yeah, some kind of, you know, some kind of sci-fi term is what Brian said. Yeah, I think that's right. But so then I usually use being or living being, you know, that's a little easier to understand. But then the altruistic spirit of enlightenment is talking about this attitude of the bodhisattva, just that they only want enlightenment. They only want to become a perfectly enlightened, or only want to reach in perfect enlightenment for the sake of others, you know, in order to benefit others. So that they have that attitude constantly. That's the bodhisattva attitude. The spirit of enlightenment. The spirit of enlightenment means that it's only for others. You know, then otherwise, what's enlightenment? You know, there's nothing. Why would you want to get it if you didn't want to be of help to others? That's the idea. You have it, Nick. You have a question?
No.
So you can hand it back. Yeah.
Thank you.
So I think actually we're going over time here. Maybe it's a good. What we do at the end of the class is to dedicate what any kind of virtue we say, any kind of good causes that we've created, to share them with other living beings. I was about to say sentient beings. No, I
wouldn't. Know what it is.
Now that you know it, okay. So in order, we say these two last verses here. I dedicate all this virtue to emulate the knowledge of the hero Manjushri, and likewise Samantabhadra as well. With whatever dedication is praised as supreme by all the conquerors of the verse the three times, I also dedicate all my roots of virtue for the sake of auspicious deeds.
Thank you, Joshua.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Joshua.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thursday, right?